Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Batabi Levantombeni, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Today we talk about the economy, your economy to be precise. Are the signs of the economic times calling for greater individual economic independence? With economic growth at near stagnant levels, can the average American afford to rely on having a job in order to survive? I am joined by Pankaj Amin, who returns to the show to discuss these and other issues concerning your new economy. You are listening to Michelle Webb. The CD is called DC Istanbul. The piece is called Zeynel. Sit back and listen and enjoy while everyone gathers. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Batabi Levantombeni, couples and divorce mediator. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If you have an issue that just won't go away, work it out in couples mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I can guide you through the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. If you'd like to call into the show, dial 818-532-9789. We welcome callers and questions and comments, especially for the show today. And we also have a chat room this week, so look for the instructions on how to join the chat room. And as actually, I know from looking at the website, if you scroll down just a little bit, the chat room should be there and you should be able to jump right in and participate. There you can chat with other listeners and you can ask questions or make comments. I will stop in from time to time and you can get your questions and comments answered on the air. And that's great for those of you who are a little on the shy side. You don't want to actually be heard on the air, but you want to get your question on the air. Post it up in the chat room and I'll try to make sure to get it in. My guest today is Pankaj Amin. He is sitting right here next to me in my fabulous studio. which is actually covered in boxes because I'm moving this weekend. So it's a kind of unusual situation for me. It's a working studio, that's right. I've taken a few minutes out of packing boxes and so forth to air the show because I didn't want to miss a single week with you. So I'm very happy for Pentish to be here. Pentish, this is your second time here on the show, actually.
That's correct. And yeah, thank you so much for having me today. It was such a pleasure being here last time, and I look forward to chatting with your listeners again today.
Well, for folks who didn't hear the last show, and I encourage you to do that, it's available on demand. It's a show called Turning Your Business into Gold or something of that nature. But go ahead and listen to it. But for those who didn't have a chance to listen to it, give me a little bit of background about yourself and your area of expertise.
Sure. So my background is I am like many people probably listening, I was a small business owner. I bought a business, a telecom company out in California. I ran it for 7 years, and I just recently sold it. I have an MBA and an engineering degree, so I have a background both in business and in technology. And what I really enjoy doing is showing people who are aspiring to be entrepreneurs some of the pathways and the information necessary to get there. So in conjunction with that, I've been teaching at Rutgers, and I'm also looking forward to sharing some of those ideas with you, with your listeners and you today.
Well, fantastic. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are listening with bated breath and open ears to hear what we have to say today, especially since we're in the middle of an unprecedented crisis with Congress and the White House at loggerheads over the issue of the debt ceiling. We have a significant issue with what might happen with the economy. You know, it makes me really nervous when my well-being is in the hands of other people like that. And I'm interested in making that I have as much say in the direction of my own economic well-being. So that's something that we'd like to talk about today.
And one thing I would say to that, because this is a very timely show that you're doing today, since the debt ceiling crisis is going to hit on Tuesday. Who would have thought that we'd be here on Sunday afternoon without a deal yet?
Right. I didn't know what to call the show.
But what I will say is that it is the early rumblings of what's probably to come in terms of decisions that the government has to make. So what I mean by that is up until now, the government has been able to kick the can down the road by either not raising taxes and not reducing spending and either financing their way towards making everybody happy, but not really making the hard decisions that they have to make to balance the budget. We haven't really had a balanced budget in 30 years, with the exception of maybe 1 year during the Clinton era. And so consequently, we're now in a position where financing and moving things around are not necessarily going to be solutions anymore. S&P and Moody's have both said that they are putting the United States on negative watch for its credit rating. Right. And so unless we make some of the tough decisions about cuts or raising revenue, we're not going to be able to make we're not going to be able to make it work, as Tim Gunn would say. And so what that means for us as individuals is that we can't really rely on payments or contracts or other types of benefits from the government as being absolute. We have to really take accountability for our own situation, and that's going to have major ramifications in terms of decisions that we make for ourselves.
Right, exactly. And speaking of being able to rely on the government for certain things, things have also changed in terms of other ways that people traditionally relied on to make a living. For example, it used to be that you perhaps graduate from high school or you graduate from college, you get a job at a corporation, you work there for 30, 40 years. When you retire, you have a pension, and you live out the rest of your life. Now, that ended a while ago.
That's gone,
That was gone.
The notion of a pension is, in corporate America, is pretty much gone for people even in our generation or even older than us. So since you and I are both 21, but that way. You're being honest, right?
I'm 27.
So, but the notion of a pension is pretty much gone for Americans at this point, unless you work for the government. And even in the government sector, you're going to probably see that pension benefits and other types of retirement benefits are going to start being dismantled because of the fiscal realities that they're facing.
But just to be sure that people understand, what is the difference between a pension benefit and what most people have now in terms of like a 401k?
Okay.
Something like that?
So a pension benefit is usually what they would call a defined benefit pension, What that means is that you, when you retire at a certain age or a certain tenure, you're going to be given a specific benefit. You may get $30,000 a year, $50,000 a year, X amount a year as your benefit from your pension package. That's what they call a defined benefit
pension. It's
guaranteed
pension. You're going to get it
guaranteed,
no matter what.
And it is guaranteed to in many ways at a very high level. Even if a company goes bankrupt, that pension benefit gets transferred over to the government. There's a corporation that the government manages to guarantee those pension benefits for corporations. So a defined benefit pension is fairly secure in terms of its solvency, and it's also very, you know, fairly expensive for people to administer. So what corporations did over the last 20 years is they started transitioning their employees from that defined benefit plan to a 401k, which is called a defined contribution plan. What that means is that you might get a tax benefit for contributing to an employee-based pension fund. So your 401k plan, you might put $5,000 a year into that plan, and you get a $5,000 tax deduction from your tax and income taxes today, and you'll have to pay income taxes on that money when you take money out of that plan when you retire after 59 and a half. What you find is that defined contribution plan is much more, it's much more sensitive or reliant on the caprice of the market.
Because
you're investing in the stock market.
So you're
taking on the risk of the stock market going up or going down in terms of the value of that 401k plan. Whereas with a defined benefit plan, whoever is administering that plan is taking the risk of the stock market or whatever they've invested their fund in. They're taking that risk because they have to give you a certain amount of money at the end of the year.
No matter what happens. So it used to be that the employers bore the risk of the amount of money in the plan being enough to actually pay it out. And the way that they might increase the amount of that money is to invest it, and that might be in the stocks and bonds, that sort of thing. But they invested the money, and whether or not the stocks went up and down or down, they have to pay a certain amount to you. Now you said that the burden has shifted to the employees, so that as happened with the recession in 2009 and before, all of a sudden people found that they couldn't retire because their plans had been wiped out.
Because their 401k had been wiped out.
Exactly.
Now they're making those investment decisions. You can decide to invest 100% of your 401k in Apple stock, and maybe you do really well with that, or you could put 100% of your 401k into pets.com and you don't do so well with that.
Right.
So those are decisions that you get both the burden, but also I would call it the responsibility and the accountability of the performance of that fund.
Well, but what that means is that as employees or as individuals who are participating in the market, participating in the economy, we have to educate ourselves. You know, we need to know now what's going on. It used to be that it was just, you know, the company took care of it. Your pension was going to get paid no matter what. Now people actually have to know something.
Absolutely.
About how to maximize the potential of this new system.
Absolutely. And I would take it a step further by saying corporations in the last 15 years relinquished their responsibility for, quote unquote, taking care of employees into retirement. And what we're going to see in the next 15 or 20 years is that the government is going to relinquish its responsibility for, quote unquote, taking care of citizens, because we're not really employees of the country. So we're going to find that, and there are a number of different ways in which they can do that, but we're going to see that the burden of managing your money or managing your financial independence is going to become yours, even on that third leg, Social Security or other types of entitlement plans that the federal government administers.
And, you know, I've been talking about the direction of the show. We've talked about this before the show. And it's something that I see coming, something that you've been talking with me about. We've talked about it a little bit on the show you were on before. And it's something that I'd like to focus on, because people are going to need to have different kinds of information than they needed to have before in order to do well in the upcoming economy. If you don't know these things, you could find yourself in big trouble, and there is no bailout for us.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit then about the behavior of the big guys in the game. We've talked about the government behavior, Congress is doing its behavior right now, and I think people are far more alert to what's happening in government than they've been in quite a while. You know, everybody's watching the news. We actually tuned in to watch the president speak last week about what was going on. But on the other hand, I'm thinking that perhaps we're focusing too much on what's going on in Congress. I don't know that Congress is really in charge anymore. Or that the government is really in charge anymore. There's a quote that's been going around on Facebook that notes that Apple Corporation has more cash than the United States government.
Mm-hmm.
Apple Corporation has on hand more cash than the United States government. Now, that's power.
Mm-hmm.
And when you multiply that by the number of corporations that are the size of Apple, the corporations together wield quite a bit of power relative to the government, don't they?
That's absolutely correct. And I think that and it's hard for people to deny that. I think that when you look at corporations, and what one thing I do want to say is one of my favorite, as a theater person in college, one of my favorite plays is Noises Off. And Noises Off is a whole play, it's a two-act play. The first act is a story that takes place, it's a play that takes place. And then the whole second act, what they do is they show you everything that takes place backstage.
Yes.
And what you find out in this play is that the things that go on backstage are always more exciting and dramatic than the things that go on stage.
Sure.
Anyone who has done any theater probably knows that, because there's all these extra dramas going on behind stage between the cast and the crew and the whoever.
Right.
So the lesson from that play, in my opinion, is yeah, you can look at what's going on in Congress right now at this moment, but it's also as important or more important to know what's going on backstage throughout this type of negotiation, as well as even to, you know, negotiations prior to this that led up to today.
Right.
And what you're talking about corporations and their power within Washington is exactly right on, because there has been an increasing amount of influence that corporations have on regulations that are made in Washington, how spending is made, spending decisions that are made, and contracts that are given out in Washington, and other types of corporate or criminal conduct that gets prosecuted in Washington,
or
doesn't get prosecuted.
Exactly. Isn't that an interesting thing? People have talked about how many lives were ruined by corporate malfeasance, and mm-hmm. yet nobody has gone to jail.
Yeah. So, you know, in even during the Bush years with Enron and WorldCom and all of the corporations that went out of business during that period, we actually did take many of those people to justice and prosecute some of those CEOs. In the last financial crisis with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch and a whole host of banks that have gone out of business, as well as other corporations that were bailed out by the government, we haven't seen anyone be held accountable for the malfeasance that occurred during the 2008-2007 financial crisis. What that means is, getting back to your comment about Apple, I think that people can say that a number of corporations have more than enough cash to finance and fund the prospects of various congressmen and congresswomen and their campaigns, so that they can get some type of favor in return. Now, they would always deny that, but the reality is that the pockets are deep enough for a corporation to get that type of influence in Washington, and no individual investor or most individual investors don't have the type of financial, you know, wealth to be able to influence people at that level.
Well, now this takes it just a little bit off the track that we're on. We're going to be talking about ways of influencing regulation, because that's something that's really important. We're going to bring that into the conversation. But I want to again highlight what you're saying. I had a guest a couple of weeks ago who was talking about the marriage equality bill. Kathy Marino Thomas, And we talked about what kinds of things an average person, a grassroots person needs to do, or grassroots organization needs to do in order to influence how legislation is made. And she talked about supporting candidates that you know are going to support you. And one of the things that we're seeing in Congress today are candidates who are standing on principle. And they're standing on principle based on the fact that they were put there by
constituents,
grassroots people. So it is possible, if people organize and are steadfast, for them to be able to, in a sense, counter or put in their two cents, so to speak, versus what's going on with the corporations. But the thing that's important is to learn from the corporate action.
Exactly. And what I would say is that, sure, organizing a grassroots campaign and exerting influence on congressmen or congresswomen in that fashion is one leg of your strategy as an individual. I think the other leg of your strategy should be understanding how the rules are written and how they benefit certain classes of people or certain classes of behavior, more importantly, and figuring out how you can become one of the people who is benefited in that process as well. So, and what I mean by that is, so for example, a lot of times people in Washington will talk about raising income taxes on the rich. And they'll say, well, we need to raise income taxes on people who make more than $250,000 a year. What they don't normally tell you is that there are two, broadly speaking, two different types of income that people pay income taxes on. And so when they make a statement that, you know, some hedge fund manager pays a lower tax rate than his or her secretary, what they're really doing is they're intimating to the fact that there is an ordinary income tax rate and a capital gains income tax rate. And those are two very different income tax rates, as well as you are assessed those income tax rates on two very different types of activity. So for example, ordinary income taxes are taxes that most of us pay, and we pay them based on, you know, if we have a job, we get a W-2 at the end of the year, we're assessed an ordinary income tax rate for that. If we have money in a CD at Wells Fargo or at Bank of America or some big bank, we get interest on that. We might not be getting much right now, but we get interest on that, and that interest is assessed at an ordinary income tax rate.
Okay.
Capital gains is assessed differently, and it's a flat 15%, which is where you get this number that people refer to. If you have a long-term capital gains gain, then you will pay a flat 15% on that.
And what kinds of things incur a capital gain?
So the things that incur a capital gain are if you buy a stock and hold it for more than a year and then sell it, that would be a long-term capital gain, and you pay 15% on that return. So if you bought Apple at $100 and it went up to $200 13 months later, then you would only pay 15% on the gain, which is $100. So you'd pay $15 of taxes for that gain.
But if I earned that $100 as income, I might be taxed 40%.
Correct. That's correct.
So
you might be taxed, well, up to 30. We're only talking about federal here, so up to 35%.
Okay, so up to 35%, but it's still more than double.
More than double. That's
it's
exactly
5%
right.
More than double, but it's still more than double.
That's
what
exactly right.
I would be charged if I were earning that money on a long-term stock.
Correct.
Rather
so,
than...
and that's a distinction that is not very well made in the soundbite world of Washington politics.
Okay.
So unfortunately, people listen to what politicians say, and if they don't understand the nuances of how they're making these statements, then they're not in a position to really make an informed decision about A, whether or not they agree with the person who is making that statement, but also B, what would I do to be the type of person who is paying the 15% capital gains as opposed to the 35% or the 30%
on income.
Or ordinary income.
On ordinary income,
yeah.
Right.
You
yeah.
see what I'm saying?
Right.
So that has to be a second leg of your strategy in addition to grassroots campaigning. Because then once you understand and know how the system is designed today, you can make decisions on how you can appropriately react or advance your own financial situation.
This is an excellent moment. We're going to take a quick break. It's actually time for a break. But what I want folks to be thinking about during the break is this particular point, because that's exactly where the direction of the show is going. Talking with folks about how they can change their economic behavior to be able to take the best advantage of our economic system and survive the fact that the economy has changed, and it is changing in a profound way. I'm going to play a song for you. It's called Race Face by Brandon Roth. It's from his album Costume, and that album is available for purchase on iTunes. I encourage you to go out and get it. This is a wonderful musician that I hope that you get to know. We'll be back in just a moment. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the personal, social, and financial issues that concern you most. I am your host, Batabi Livintombini, relationship coach and divorce mediator, broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in couples and divorce mediation. If you have an issue that just won't go away, work it out in couples mediation. If ending a relationship is your healthiest choice, I will guide the process so that you don't lose your shirt or your mind. Work out your child support and parenting issues without spending years in court. For more information, visit my website, www.123untangled.com. That's www.123untangled.com. Speaking of child support and parenting issues, last night I saw a wonderful performance of a show called Growing Up Daddy. And the show is written and performed by Kral K.O. Charles. And it's about a man grappling with unexpected fatherhood and remembering his own life growing up separated from his father. It is an excellent show, and I was so impressed by it that I've asked Kral K.O. Charles to be my guest on the show in a couple of weeks. So please look out for that and plan to see the show for yourself if you are in the New York area on August 27th. That's when the next showing of this wonderful one-man play is going to be, and I believe it will be at the Harlem School of the Arts. That's August 27th here in New York City. I will have Mr. Charles on the show in a couple of weeks, and we'll, of course, give out more information about that. I also invite you to follow the blog that is a companion to this show. It is at untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. Untangled Resolutions, all one word, .blogspot.com. And this is where you can find links to the resources mentioned on the show and learn more about the music and the musicians that I feature. And I'm a huge supporter of independent music and independent musicians, and that's what I play here on the show so that you can get to know them. So feel free to join in at untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. It's also an opportunity for you to continue the conversation that was started here on the show, so please jump in and let your voice be heard. All right, so we are coming back to our conversation. I'm here with Pankaj Amin, and we're talking about the new economy, or your new economy, actually. We're talking about the ways in which people's behavior is going to have to change in order to thrive, do better than just survive, but to actually thrive in what we're seeing develop post-Great Recession, if you want to call it that. But before we get back to our conversation, we actually have a caller who has a question here on the line. This is from the 909 area code. Caller, you are on the air.
Thank you so very much for having me on your program. And Mr. Amin, I'm so happy that you came back because we have a long list of questions.
Oh, no.
I've just selected a few today so I don't dominate the show. My last question today will be the one that's very relevant. But my first question is, we still are enjoying the Bush tax cuts. Why are we not seeing job creation now when we're having this tax cut? And yet we're complaining that if taxes are raised, jobs will not be created. Why aren't we creating them now during this period of cuts?
Well, sir, I would probably argue that the Bush tax cuts are not what was – there was not a causal relationship between the Bush tax cuts and job creation in this last expansion that we had from 2003 to 2007. I would argue that what was really the driver for job growth during that period was Alan Greenspan lowering interest rates down – the Fed funds rate down to 1% for almost 18 months in 2002. And so, and that created a whole industry of mortgage refinancing and a whole cycle of financial tactics that created job growth during that period of time. So, it's an ongoing debate for economists whether these tax cuts are really going to create more jobs. I actually don't think that the current Bush tax cuts are creating jobs at the small business level. Why is that? I would say that the reason why is because as a small business person, small business people are going to look for opportunities where they can provide a service or a product that people are willing to pay for and want to buy. And when they see that, so if we had a taco stand on 116th and Broadway, if we knew that people wanted to buy more tacos, we would invest in hiring someone and opening up another taco stand. If we don't see that demand, we're not going to open up another taco stand. Since we're not seeing that end demand, small businesses collectively are not hiring. And I don't think a further tax cut will alleviate that, nor do I think that rolling back the tax cuts are going to critically harm that either. So I don't think that that's the driver, that's the lever that is driving or impeding job growth at this time.
Oh, thank you so much. Actually, you already answered my second question.
Awesome.
Because I used to run a small business, and what determined whether I was hiring or not hiring was revenue.
Exactly.
Am I going to be making money or not making money? But taxes.
What type of business did you run?
One way or another.
What type of business did you run, sir?
I ran a medical clinic.
Okay, great. So as someone who was running a medical clinic, you knew that if you didn't, you're taking on the responsibility and the liability and the accountability of hiring another nurse or another doctor or another practitioner in your clinic. And so if you couldn't reliably see patients demanding or needing the services that you were providing, you're not going to do it because you are taking on that responsibility of having those people on your payroll. So that's the main driver that people are looking at when they see when they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to hire.
And I think the caller also did say that taxes did not influence his decision on hiring. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Mhm.
Yes, yeah. I would say that, because my tax will go up by 5%, I'm going to forgo making a profit because my taxes have gone up. So it didn't make sense. Yeah.
Did you have another question, or has that answered your question, actually?
Now I have the last question, which is the real question. They say it is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And here we are facing... I'm facing a double darkness in that I paid into Social Security, hoping that it would be there for me. It seems to be in danger. I had a pension fund. That seems to be in danger, too, as the stock market is not doing too well. So how do you start a small business on a shoestring advertising budget? For instance, now, I want to start a tourism business, but I have a very small budget. Any suggestions as to what I can do for advertising on a shoestring?
Okay. One thing that I would say, and this is, I teach a course at a nonprofit in New Jersey regarding kind of micro entrepreneurship, people who are looking to maybe not necessarily hire employees, but provide a service that they want to provide to the community or to the market. And what I have often told people at the small business level, advertising is usually exorbitantly expensive, and it's an expensive way to kind of get your word out. So consequently, small business people, the benefit for small business people, let me give you that, is that you don't need to have the same type of revenue that GE or Apple or ExxonMobil has in order to survive. So you don't need to make a huge splash in your market. You just need a couple of ripples that will get you a smaller amount of revenue because you're a smaller business. The way in which you do that cost effectively, in my opinion, is I call them power partners. So for example, if you're in the tourism business, what I would look for are people who are in adjacent or similar businesses to you that you can plug into the network. You want to be in order to be able to sell your work or sell your product, you need to be part of a larger network. Rather than be one fish swimming on its own, you want to be part of a school of fish swimming together. And so if you can find a power partners to work with, then that will help you go out to market together. The reason why I tell you that, and this is maybe a little bit more background about my business than you might want to know, but I ran a telecom business in California. And the way in which we grew our business, we installed and maintained telecom equipment, and I partnered informally with sales reps at AT&T, Comcast, Telepacific, XO Communications, CBeyond. There was a whole roster. There's a whole bunch of carriers that provide telecom services to businesses. And what I found was that if Jane at Telepacific was trying to sell a circuit, a telephone line into a doctor's office or a lawyer's office, oftentimes in order for her to close her deal, she needed someone like me to sell new equipment because their old equipment that they currently had wouldn't work on the new circuit that she was selling them. So she needed someone like me to close my business in order for her to close her business. That was a perfect power partner for me because that meant that we were going out to market together. You know, a not so and I'll contrast that with a not so perfect power partner. A not so perfect power partner was a commercial real estate broker. A commercial real estate broker would know who is building out a new office in a high rise in San Francisco, but he had something to offer me, but I didn't necessarily have anything to offer him. So that would be not necessarily a symbiotic relationship, but a one-way relationship. It doesn't work as well. So if you can find that symbiotic relationship, and then what you do is you groom those relationships. If you can have, and then you have to sit down and do some numbers. You know, how many of those types of relationships do you need in order to sustain your business? In my business, for instance, in telecom, we had 55 people like that. And we found that was enough for us to kind of double the size of our business because we were constantly getting leads and potential customers from these people these relationships we were cultivating. And consequently, we did no advertising in the process. So what I would say is, you know, advertising is like a blanket, but you really want to try and focus your efforts and try and focus them on the people who are going to get in front of the specific customers that are relevant to the product or service that you offer.
Now, I also want to add to that, I'm going to be asking Pankaj to come back. We are going to expand the topics that we're talking about, expand them in terms of number, but then also define them, get a little bit more narrow. And so we will talk about entrepreneurship and have a show that is specifically about advertising and prospecting and, you know, how to make a sale and so forth. So I encourage you to listen to future editions of the show, but I'm also curious to hear whether this answer was what you were looking for.
I rate it as excellent. And
well,
I hope Amir comes back again and again and again, especially during this time, you know, of uncertainty.
Yes.
And, yes, your contributions are just excellent. Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And I look forward to, again, as I said, Pankaj, having you back, and I want folks who are listening to know that they can rely on this show to provide them with the kinds of ideas that can help them to adjust to this economy. And, you know, before the break, we were talking about regulations and maximizing behavior or adjusting behavior to maximize benefit from the regulations that exist and how it is that the corporations are able to do that, and perhaps there's something that we can learn from that. I had a moment of epiphany that got me started on this road. I was one of those people who was terribly upset to hear that major corporations had made oodles of profit and were not paying taxes. And so I was as incensed as the average person, and I actually took action and went to a march. A protest and then a march, and we were protesting Bank of America, Union Square here in New York City. And we had our placards, and we were marching, and we were saying, pay your taxes, pay your taxes. And then it came to me, you know, actually, I thought we were banging on the wrong door. Because it's not as though Bank of America was shirking paying taxes.
Uh-huh.
Actually, Bank of America had no taxes to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way that the tax code was written allowed them to take advantage of certain kinds of deductions, or if you want to call them loopholes. President Obama has spoken about closing certain loopholes, and this is the kind of thing that he's talking about. And then April came,
mm-hmm.
and I filed my own taxes.
Okay.
And I have a business. I myself am a small business owner, and I registered my business last year. This is the first year that I'm filing taxes as a business owner. And when I finished filling out all the forms, the refund that was due to me had me hanging with my mouth hanging open. I was, in fact, almost afraid to file because it was so much that I was sure that I was going to get that knock on that door, that dreaded knock on the door. But I went through and double-checked every line, and sure enough, all of the deductions that I took were due to me. I had backup information for every single one of them. In fact, I was actually really conservative mm-hmm. about what I claimed. And yet here it was where everybody else or a lot of people that I was talking to were crying about writing that check because they owe taxes. I was getting this enormous refund. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking about the kinds of behavior that the tax code rewards and mm-hmm. that I happened to be engaging in the kind of behavior that the tax code rewards. So I want to talk a little bit about that.
And I think that that's a really good build on top of the what we had talked about earlier before the break, which was there are two legs or two strategies for reacting to the government's actions in this type of environment. One strategy is to coalesce and create grassroots pressure on the government to change their behavior. And another action is to say, well, let me understand that behavior or understand the current structure and adapt, right? Now, protesting Bank of America is something that you can certainly do, and they may not be paying taxes because they're not assessed taxes, but they might not be assessed taxes because of a number of loopholes or regulations that they have lobbied for within the government. So one action which kind of falls into that first leg is to say, let's lobby at a grassroots level for changes in the tax structure so that Bank of America or other corporations like them are assessed taxable, you know, they're assessed taxes that are commensurate with the type of business and the type of profits that they demonstrate every quarter. So change the tax code so that it's fair or fairer. That I think is very akin to trying to what we had talked about earlier as that first leg.
Mm-hmm.
The second leg is understanding the current tax structure and adapting to it is very akin to what you just described with your own situation, which is, okay, if I'm an entrepreneur and I file, if you're a sole proprietor, which I believe you are, and you file a Schedule C, which is the schedule that you file for as a sole proprietor, then you'll find out that you are now eligible to deduct relevant business expenses from your revenue as part of that Schedule C that you file
right.
every year.
And since I have a home office,
yeah,
that was just, you know, I was able to deduct a portion of my home.
Of your rent, yeah.
A portion of my rent, a portion of my utilities, a portion of all the things that went into making the business run.
Yep. And now you did also mention, I just want to briefly touch on this, you also mentioned your fear of being audited.
Sure.
And one thing to understand in that process is what are some of the triggers the things in your return that will trigger an audit from the IRS. On a Schedule C as a sole proprietor, the most common trigger, to my understanding, is if you file a Schedule C that has a negative profit at the end of the year, or if you file an overall 1040 that has a negative, that has no income, a negative income at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a trigger, because then the government is trying to figure out how are you surviving
mm-hmm.
if you're supposedly not making any money.
Right.
If you have a corporation, an S corporation or a small corporation, the most common trigger is if you do not pay yourself on a W-2.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't pay yourself, and it's important to understand the differences, why these are different triggers, and this is because on a Schedule C as a sole proprietor, you're assessed what they call a self-employment penalty tax, which means you pay your Social Security as well as the employer contribution of your Social Security. That ends up being 13% instead of 6.5%. As a S corporation, if you don't pay yourself payroll taxes by putting yourself on payroll, you don't end up, you end up kind of going around that Social Security. So the triggers are there for two different reasons. And a sole proprietor, you're basically getting a trigger because they're looking for deductions that may not qualify as deductions in their mind.
Right.
As an S corporation, they're looking for Social Security income that you may not have paid yourself. You know, you may not have paid into the Social Security system by getting around Social Security by not putting yourself on payroll on a W-2.
So, but a major point of this is that there are things that folks are going to need to be intelligent about, to look out for, and these are the things that we will talk about in more detail in shows to come when we speak specifically about, for example, the tax code and how to maximize the tax code. But I want folks to know that this is an issue, it is a topic of interest, and that... you know, lighting a candle rather than cursing the darkness. Perhaps one of the ways to address what's going on with the economy is rather than cursing the corporations, figure out how they tick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is it that they're working, and is there a way that I can modulate my behavior to be able to take care, take advantage of what they are receiving as well.
And one other thing I would say to that is that the there is a statistic in New Jersey, over 100,000 employees of the pharmaceutical industry were laid off in the last 2 to 3 years. That's a large portion of New Jersey's economy, and a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry who, if they had worked in that industry for 20 or 25 years, frankly, they're gonna have a hard time finding another job at another pharmaceutical, large pharmaceutical employer. On the flip side, there are a number of small consultancies that provide medical marketing, medical scientific research, medical continuing medical education, that they serve the pharmaceutical industry, and those businesses are doing
quite
well because the 100,000 people that were laid off represents a cost cut for the pharmaceutical industry, but a lot of that work still has to get done. And so what they're doing is instead they're outsourcing that to third-party firms.
Now you've really hit the nail on the head as to where I want to go with this show, because you've talked about what I'm sort of calling internal outsourcing. So in prior years, in the last few years, we've talked about, or we've heard about, corporations outsourcing work overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're seeing a trend where corporations are outsourcing their work, if you will, to small businesses here in the United States. And so I'm interested in helping folks to be able to take advantage of that too, especially people who are professionals who have been in the industry and have a lot of experience. And as you said, they are having a horrible time finding work.
But what they can do is if you have 25 years of experience at a pharmaceutical company and you just got laid off, well, guess what? You have 25 years worth of relationships and contacts within that industry that you can bring to the table to a smaller consulting firm. Even if you didn't want to work on your own, you could probably go to a different type of firm and offer something relevant and valuable to them. So the question is really, if what you have to offer, you can't sell it back into the same type of buyer that you had before, which would be a large pharmaceutical employer in this example, then you need to turn the table a little bit and see where you can offer your skill set to someone who will find it relevant. And there will be ways in which you can do that.
Well, and here's something else then in terms of the way that people can imagine themselves as actors in the economy. It's something that has always been, but you know, perhaps hasn't been thought of in this way. When you have a job and you're going to work every day, you may think of yourself as an employee, but in a sense you are an entrepreneur. You own your services and you are giving your services to the corporation in exchange for a paycheck, but under a particular kind of relationship.
Right.
The nature of that relationship has changed. It has changed permanently.
I agree. And I would build on that by saying that we are all quote unquote entrepreneurs when we go to work each day. However, for most of us who have been working in a job for the last 20 years, 25 years, that's a muscle, that entrepreneurship muscle is a muscle that we may or may not have exercised to the best of our ability. And specifically, knowing how to sell, knowing what other people want to buy and are willing to pay for, and knowing how to perform all the administrative tasks surrounding that and delivering a service, and selling a service, those are skills that you have to have in a large organization, but you're not necessarily required to
exercise
that muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you know, this show is really it's really like a self-fitness program.
Yes.
for the skills that you have to be more effective in an entrepreneurial environment.
And that's exactly what we're going to continue doing going forward, building on it whenever I have Pankaj back. We will be talking about how you can be prepared if you find yourself in a situation where you no longer can rely on a job in order to meet your financial needs. And a lot of people are finding themselves in that situation. People who worked hard, did all the right things, went to school, finished their degrees, and worked faithfully, to have found themselves laid off and on welfare, of all things, unable to rely on having a job. So we want to make sure that folks are empowered and enabled to be able to take care of themselves economically in the new economy as it develops. So, Pankaj, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yes. And I look forward to developing these thoughts with you and sharing them with the folks who listen to the show. And, yes, everyone, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. If you have further comments or want to ask questions, feel free to visit the blog, untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. That's untangledresolutions.blogspot.com. And if you can't write that down right this minute, that's fine, because the show is available on demand, and usually within about 20 minutes of airing, the show will be available on demand here on Blog Talk Radio. So I'm going to leave you now with a piece from Valerie June, a singer-songwriter and guitarist who is near and dear to my heart, as I said last week. I played her song Rain Dance from her Valerie June and the Tennessee Express album, because we were just dying of heat here on the Northeast. Pankaj lives here as well, and he knows exactly
what I was talking
about. It was phenomenal, right? We were just dying, so I played the song Rain Dance, and it worked. It actually worked. So we had wonderful rain this last week, and the temperature is much, much better. So I'm going to end the show with another piece of hers again. And it's a piece called Parting Words, which describes how I'm feeling about Congress right about now. It's a breakup song, and it's from her album, Mountain of Rose Quartz. And the album is available online at Valerie's website, valeriejune.com. Have a wonderful week, everybody. And remember, you can take charge of your own economy. And we're going to talk more about how to do that in upcoming shows. Join me back here next week again at this time for another wonderful show. Have a wonderful week. And the love.